This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today in the program, a panel of experts offers insights and ideas on how we can all work to improve air quality in Utah through activism, engagement, mobilization, and accountability. They also discuss why air quality is essential to environmental sustainability and public health, as bad air contributes to increased rates of deadly diseases and shorter lifespans. An analysis of air quality released in January examined 2018 air quality data and found that Salt Lake City has some of the worst air quality in the nation, coming in at number 7 among large metro areas. Earlier this month, University of Utah researchers put out a report showing the difference in air quality during quarantine conditions. The data shows a decrease of traffic by 40 to 50% due to coronavirus mitigation efforts led to nitric oxide levels dropping by 57%, nitric dioxide dropping by 36%, and fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, dropping by 59% in comparison to yearly averages. Carbon dioxide, the most prevalent greenhouse gas, dropped by 19% and 33% in the Sugar House and University of Utah areas, respectively. While the decline in traffic didn't affect all air quality signifiers, such as ozone and sulfur dioxide, the significant drop in statewide air pollution has jump-started a conversation on the environmental benefits of Utahns teleconferencing and working from home. Today's panel highlights local efforts to improve air quality, as well as how individuals can get involved directly. On the panel is Logan E. Mitchell, PhD and Research Assistant Professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah, Scott Williams, Executive Director of Heal Utah, and Johnny Vasek, Executive Director of Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Moderating the discussion is Piper Christian, Student Ambassador from the U's Sustainability Office. This forum was recorded on February 11th, 2020. Here is your moderator, Piper Christian.
So just to begin, we'd like to start out with introductions. If the three of you would be willing to take 3 to 5 minutes to share a bit about yourself and your work within your organizations.
You want me to start?
Go for it.
So I'm Scott Williams. I'm a pediatrician by training, and then I retired, and then I had grandkids, and Trump got elected, and I decided I needed to not just sit home and complain, but do something to hand my grandkids a better world. So I'm now the executive director of Heal Utah, Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah. I've been there about 2.5 years. We work on 3 issues. We work on air quality, clean energy, and radioactive waste. And radioactive waste is our legacy issue. It's what Heal was founded around 20 years ago. We do mostly grassroots organizing, so we have a supporter base of about 15,000 people that we send out action alerts to and keep up to date on the policy issues that are happening in Utah. We do citizen lobbying, so right now on every Tuesday and Thursday we host groups of citizens at the legislature and teach them how to lobby their legislator and what issues are current right now up there. And then we do policy work. So we do a lot of policy analysis. What's worked in other states? How do you define the problem? How do you focus in on solutions that are politically doable and effective? And then we try to implement those solutions at either the state, local, or federal level.
Thank you. Logan?
My name is Logan Mitchell. I'm a research scientist here at the University of Utah in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. A lot of the research that I'm working on focuses on understanding very fine-scale spatial patterns of air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions and how those two things are related. Ultimately, we want to try to understand what are the health outcomes across a city, because we know that pollution is not distributed uniformly across an area. But lately, I've been also engaged with the Utah Roadmap effort, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And I was on the technical advisory team and coming up with a roadmap for Utah on air quality and climate policies going into the future. So that's been a really exciting forum to engage with policymakers and other decision makers in the state. And it's kind of setting some of the, you know, helping to set the tone for the future of policy on those topics in Utah, which is really exciting.
I'm Johnny Vasek and Executive Director of Utah Physicians, as I was introduced. We have a saying on our bumper sticker at Utah Physicians: ask your doctor if clean air is right for you. And if your doctor says no, you should start looking for a new doctor. So I often get asked if I am a doctor, and I'm not. So Scott's our doctor up here today. But I did play one in a movie once as an extra. So that doesn't really count. But our board is made up of mostly physicians, although you don't have to be a member, or you don't have to be a doctor to be a member of UPHE. We are an advocacy group, an education group. We do a little bit of policy, but that's not really our forte, although I'm getting more into it as I spend time up at the Capitol during legislative session, and that just depresses me, so then I have to get out and go skiing or something. but we do, we've been around for about 12 years, and we get out and do a lot of education. We really want people to know about air quality and how that can affect them, and empower people to take things into their own hands to change maybe what their behaviors are for health reasons, or behaviors of our elected officials to help us all live a healthier life. We work on soil and water quality as well. But yeah, that's our, I think that's our main thing.
Wonderful, thank you. Well, now we will jump into our moderated questions. First, what are some of the most important concerns and policies that people can get involved in right now regarding air quality in Utah? And it's open to anyone.
Well, I'll start. The most immediate thing is that the governor has recommended $100 million for air quality programs in this legislative session. So right now, that's going to be decided by the end of this session in the next 4 weeks. $66 million would be allocated to electric vehicle infrastructure, so charging stations, and $34 million would be allocated to public transportation improvements, mostly routes and schedules. So one thing people can do right now is tell their legislator, I want you to seriously consider appropriating that $100 million to air quality programs. That would have a difference in the next few months if that were to happen. Last year, he recommended $100 million, and we got 29, which felt like not what we wanted, but it was $28 million more than we'd ever gotten before for air quality. So we felt pretty good about that. Second thing would be what we call smart growth. So Utah has a rapidly growing population. We have all sorts of proposals that have been brought up for Olympia Hills out in the West Jordan area. They want to build islands on Utah Lake and put housing and commercial on those. They want to develop the Cottonwood Mall site. They want to develop the Draper Prison site. And then the most notorious and famous development is the Inland Port. And all of these have the potential to increase air quality problems in the state. There are ways to do it in a 21st century way, with electrification and density and transportation and planning that can minimize, but we're not going to stop the growth of the state. The state has continued to grow in population, and so we have to anticipate that growth in a way that doesn't make our air quality worse. And then the last thing would be electrification. So the more quickly we can electrify things, and the more quickly those electrification will be powered by renewable energy, the more quickly we can reduce the emissions that are causing our problems.
Yeah, and just to jump on that, I think those are all excellent points. We all, UPHE supports all of those. The Inland Port for us is one of the top priorities and top issues this year. Who's here by a show of hands has heard of the Inland Port or know what it is? So most of us. So for us, this is the most dangerous piece of legislation that's been passed in the last 10 years. It's basically going to supercharge our economy. We already have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. We have one of the best economies in the country.
This is basically a transmodal hub for dirty fossil fuels. It'll bring dirty energy from intermountain states, hub it here, and then send it out overseas through a port on the coast. And, you know, we already have poor air quality. We already have issues with air quality. It's probably in the worst place they could pick, which is west of the airport and east of the new prison. It's a third of that area is wetland habitat, heavy mosquitoes. They'll have to spray tons of chemicals. So we are leading the charge with a Repeal the Port campaign along with Center for Biological Diversity. We held a big rally with hundreds of people last week at the Capitol. And we, if anyone in here cares about breathing clean air, I would very strongly encourage you to get involved in that topic. We're also very concerned about the Bear River Project, which is potentially going to divert water that would enter the Great Salt Lake. As the Great Salt Lake shrinks, it's a big concern because that area is super windy. That'll cause more dust and more heavy metals and things that are in that dirt and dust to enter the atmosphere and be part of what we breathe. And so that's a real concern. Those two projects together are really a death knell for our clean air. We also spend a lot of time with gravel pits and fighting to keep the gravel pits from polluting more and expanding. There's a number of gravel pits along the Wasatch Front here, and although you definitely need those at a certain time to build and for roads and such, we kind of look at it as scaffolding, where you need it when the building's being built. But once people live around that area, just like with the prison, how they had to move it out because it's so dense, we want the gravel pits to reduce their exposure to kicking up silica and stuff that we breathe that can affect our health. So, and we love the idea of charging and charging stations. We're pushing heavily as well for, we want free mass transit for everyone in this city, if not the state. That when the last year they did a couple pilot programs that Hill was involved with pushing as well of free days, and the ridership shot up hundreds of percent. So it works. It helps moderate and low income people especially, and we would love to push. I would love to see half of that money, if not more, go to subsidizing mass transit for everybody.
And I'll just say, there are a lot of specifics that both of you talked about, and I don't know, as someone in the public, you may not, I think it's not expected that you remember the details of all of these issues, because there are organizations that are working on these. And so as an individual person, maybe the most important thing that I think that you can do is just contact your legislators and tell them that you care about these topics and that you would like to see action. And there's other organizations that are out there that are figuring out the details. But the most important thing that you can do is to take that action of letting your legislator know that this is an important topic that you care about, that you would like to see progress on, because that's what's going to eventually move the needle. And so if you are overwhelmed with all of the details and are worried that you're not going to remember every specific thing about exactly how this is going to impact that, don't worry about that and focus on, you know, doing the one thing that is the most important, which is letting them know that this is an issue that you care about, that you will vote on, and that's a priority for you.
I don't think you should let them off the hook. I think they should study. This is a university. Yeah. They need to know the issue.
Well, yeah. If you want to learn the issues, that's fantastic, and it's awesome, and I've seen that being a barrier to participation.
Absolutely.
If people feel overwhelmed and worried about, oh, if I call my legislator, I don't, you know, what am I going to say? Am I going to say the wrong thing? The most important thing is that you make the call and let them know that the general topic is very important to you. And you can say, hey, I really support the work that HEAL is doing or that UPHE is doing. Mm-hmm. And say, you know, they have more of the details, but this is something that I care about.
And the way we try to get people sort of over that hump is that on our legislative citizen lobbying days, if you come up on Tuesday, we'll sit down with you for 30, 45 minutes, explain the bills, what they are supposed to do, so you have it fresh in your mind, find out who your legislator is, walk you over, pull your legislator off the floor, stand there with you while you talk to them in case you forget something, so we can sort of jump in. And so we try to help people sort of in real time be able to do that and not have to sort of go up there and freelance it on their own, because it is a process that requires some some knowledge, not just of the topics, but of the process of how to do it.
Yeah, and Hill does a great job with that. I actually had you guys help me walk through that last year. I hadn't been grown up here. I graduated from the U of U. I moved away for 20 years, although I came back to ski and visit family. Moved back 3 or 4 years ago and was just shocked by poor air quality and just was like, I got to do something. That's how I fell into this job. And then, you know, I was from California the last bit. Their legislative system works so different. So I actually saw that Hill was doing that and went up, and it can be pretty intimidating at first, but they did a great job walking you through it and just how to do it and how to focus on it. And it really took the mystery away and the fear away. So thank you, Hill.
Glad to be there.
Well, Logan's comments are a really great segue, actually, into our next question. We are all busy people. Where is it best to spend our time? Calling our representatives about specific legislation, volunteering for a local nonprofit, working on these issues, taking part in protests, educating other citizens, gathering signatures, and more. What's the best use?
Yes.
All of the above.
Well, I will say it is shocking how few people go talk to their representatives and how few phone calls they get. And just a dozen phone calls in a day or a week or a few people visiting them on a particular issue can move the needle, because most people don't do it. So for me, I think it's whatever your passion is. I think there's that saying, diversity in the movement is key. I don't think any of us know what the magic pill is or the magic bullet to solve air quality, or we'd all be doing that one thing. But I think finding your passion, what are you passionate about? Getting education on that topic, becoming an advocate, and doing what's out of your comfort zone a little bit. But I'm really good at my background's in producing film and TV, and so I've made a number of videos that I try to share, and that's one thing I can do as well as be an advocate. I'm not afraid to talk to people or go up there and, you know, get in the face of a legislator in a nice professional way to push my agenda. But I think it's finding what it suits you, but doing something is key versus nothing.
There was another climate advocate told me a nice analogy that I really like, in that imagine there's this wall, this barrier of opposition to, you know, achieving some of these outcomes, and different people have different skills and different comfort zones. And what's needed is each person to be pushing on a brick in their own way. And that's, you know, it's helpful to have people out in the streets. And it's helpful for people to be working with legislators and talking to them. Because each of those push on a different aspect of society to actually move. And you need people in both. You need people in the streets raising public awareness. And you need people in legislative office thinking about how are you going to write a bill to actually address these issues. And if you're somebody who's really passionate and wants to be out in the streets, you don't want that person in the legislative office necessarily, you know, yelling at a representative and making them feel bad and not building consensus. Likewise, if you're somebody who builds consensus and really enjoys the process of writing legislation and the incremental and negotiating over a word, you might not necessarily be the most effective person out on a campaign rally talking to a group of 1,000 people. You'd be dull as a doornail. And so it's really figuring out what your gift is, what your skill is, and figuring out how that fits into the whole. There was an article that was published in the New York Times recently that I thought gave really good advice. And they laid out 5 bullet points. And number one is to ditch the shame of your own actions. You know, we all contribute to our greenhouse gas emissions and air quality. Get over that, because we are in society, we exist in the society, and in order to make a change, we have to live and be productive. So don't worry about your own personal, worry about it, but don't be shameful to yourself. Next is focus on systems, not yourself, because ultimately, what's going to move the needle eventually is the systems, where we get our energy from, what vehicles are available for us to buy, where our industry and materials are made. And it's important to do, there's a lot of social science that says that if you're feeling hopeless and overwhelmed, doing something positive in your own life, making a change in your own life, helps to overcome that. So it is good to do personal actions, and that does move the needle very slightly. But overall, the overall solutions is going to be changing the systems. Next is to join an effective group. And we have 2 of those examples up here. And there are many other ones.
We hope so.
Next is defining your role, which is what we've just been talking about. Figure out what you're good at, what talents that you can bring to the table, and figure out how that fits in. You know, maybe you're a filmmaker, maybe you're an artist, maybe you're a scientist, maybe you're a public speaker, maybe you're a doctor. Figure out what your voice is and figure out how that fits in to the effort. And know what you're fighting for, not just what you're fighting against. Know what you're for, what you want to see happen, not just what you're fighting against. Because if you're just fighting against somebody, you're engaging in the discussion on their terms, and you're not going to eventually move the discussion to where you want it to be. So I thought that was really solid advice.
That you're so articulate. It's almost like you're a professor or something.
It's like you read a New York Times article or something. I just add a couple things to that. One is this, what I call the continuum of advocacy, from agitation to policymaking to photo ops to whatever it is, video, communicating with the public. It's all part of the change, and that's what both of these guys have been saying. And just find the lane that makes you the most comfortable. So there's us, there's Johnny's group, there's Breathe Utah, there's Sierra Club, there's Utah Clean Energy, there's Alliance for Better Utah. There's a lot of us out there working on these issues. And a board member of one of those organizations once asked me, like, why do we need all these organizations? Why don't we just have one group working on this? And I sort of paused and I said, well, why do we need more than one hamburger outlet? Why do we need more than one bank? Why do we need more than one anything? It's because that's how innovation occurs, right? You have different groups. And actually, it's much more powerful for the legislature to know that there's a lot of voices, whether it's the Utah Moms for Clean Air, or there's different sort of constituencies for this issue, and not just the environmentalists who are interested in it. So I'd encourage you to find one of those groups and support them and get involved. The other thing, one more thing, is this university actually is a major employer, major generation of commuting traffic. And so if you want to just stay close to home, talk to Piper about what you can do right here on campus to advocate for sustainability policies here and push that a little harder than it's moving right now.
Yeah, just in the paper this morning, the university just finished signing their deal to put 50%+ power to geothermal out of a power plant in Nevada. So that's a big step forward for the university. And with the new sustainability person coming in, I think the university is doing a lot of good things.
But there's one part of the university that wants to build parking lots. And there's another part of the university that wants to force people onto public transportation, make parking harder, so it isn't so easy to drive here. And so there's still a tension on this campus that I think they need to hear from both the staff and the faculty and the students about.
That was Scott Williams, Executive Director of HEAL Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today, a panel of experts discuss Utah's poor air quality and how we can effectively engage in efforts to address this major regional issue. Here again is moderator Piper Christian, student ambassador for the Sustainability Office at the University of Utah.
So we spoke briefly kind of about that balance between appreciating individual action and as well as systemic change. And this question kind of points to that. What, if anything, are you doing to empower citizens to understand the importance of individual action and its collective effect on these pressing issues of air quality and active citizenship as a whole? I'd be happy to reiterate.
Well, I mentioned our citizen lobbying. If you're talking about policy, individual action to change policy, that's primarily what we do. And then we have action alerts. If you're on our mailing list, we'll send you an action alert if there's something urgent, a vote that's coming up that we need people to call their legislator about. You'll get those action alerts, and you'll know when the timing is that a vote's coming up in a committee or on the floor. And then if it's individual action, like my lifestyle, there's a lot of things. We have a whole, and there's a question later on about the easy stuff, but maybe I'll just, so we have an acronym called Clean Air. And so
The C stands for carpool whenever possible. And there's a website called TravelWise that if you go on there, you can put in your commute and you can find other people who are heading the same direction at the same time of day, and you can set up carpools that way. And then the second one, the L is for limit cold starts. Most people don't know that starting your car in the morning when it's cold is equal to driving it when it's warm 200 miles on the highway. So if you limit how many times you're doing that, you're cold starting, and we call it trip chaining. So you organize your day and you drive to all the places you need to go if you can while your engine's warm, which decreases that. Engage in advocacy, we talked about that. A is for accessing public transportation. N is for navigating smog ratings. Know what kind of car you're buying. Ask the salesman. They probably won't know half the time what the smog rating of the car is. So make them a little uncomfortable and make them raise the hood and look and see what the smog rating of the car is. A is avoiding unnecessary commute. So we should be doing more telecommuting, more video conferencing, less driving around to get together physically with each other. And then idling less, 10 seconds of idling is after 10 seconds, you're causing more problems than just turning off your car and waiting. So we have idling ordinances. They're not very well enforced. We waste about 4 million gallons of gas in this country because of people idling their cars. And the last one, R, is ride a bike or walk to work. So there's all sorts of individual behavior things you can do, and there's policy things you can do.
Thank you.
Those are all terrific. We're for everything Scott just said. One of the things we do is we present a lot. We give a lot of presentations and lectures and talk like we're doing today. We go to schools, community groups. We have presented at the Department of Environmental Quality, the Utah Air Quality Board, many things like that to try to, you know, we do radio, TV interviews, and we take peer-reviewed research on health and environment and air quality and try to distill that for the average person to understand that there's no safe level of air pollution. All air pollution is bad for you. When the real misnomer is on a yellow day, it's only bad for sensitive groups. No, that's bad for everybody. Our group wouldn't even recommend exercising outside on a yellow day. We feel it would do more harm than it would good. And we would like that whole system of how the rating is done to be reworked, because we get this idea that, you know, it's okay because only if you have asthma, or only, of course, for sensitive groups it is bad, but it's bad for all of us. So we want to help people learn about all of the problems that can come from poor air quality, all the diseases, all the respiratory problems, and help motivate them to get out there and try to help us all clean up the air. It's going to happen all together. And what you're saying earlier about being shameful, like, I get that argument from my brothers all the time because we are on opposite sides of the spectrum. It's like, well, you drove. How can you fight for clean air? You drove here today. So, yeah, I did, but that doesn't mean I still don't want clean air. You know, there's a lot of things to that example. And, you know, we talk a lot about mobile emissions make up 50% of our, up to 50% of our bad air. And that's a real interesting statistic, because out of that, only the cars we drive are only 20 or 30% of that at most. And a lot of that is coming from diesel trucks, which have a much worse pollution for us than our cars. And we have trains, and we have other mobile source emissions like heavy machinery that are off-road vehicles, like at Kennecott and other places that don't even have emissions control limits. We don't even have an inventory on those vehicles. So there's a lot of issues that we try to get out there and educate. And just like I know all of us are for, like, this new tier three gasoline, that's just coming online in the state helped subsidize that to get that going. But if you have a car that's 2017 or newer and you put tier three gasoline in it, that can reduce your emissions by 80% of what you had before. Even with an older car, it can still reduce your emissions by 20%. You can go to tier3gas.org and find out what gas station near you is selling that. So that's a real way, even if you're going to drive, we want all of those things like free mass transit, drive less, carpool, everything, but with, you know, without policy change, that's only, we're only representing a small percentage. So I get kind of tired of people telling me that I'm the problem because I drive a car. Of course, I'm part of the problem. We all create pollution, but we have to have policy change. We have to have higher CAF standards, higher gas mileage for our cars and industrial vehicles. We have to have inventory. We have to have emissions controls for off-road vehicles. We have to stop burning wood. When we have an inversion day, up to 15% of our bad air is made up from wood smoke. So anyway, I'm kind of rambling, getting on a rant now.
So I think what I am doing to help contribute to education and public awareness is first doing basic research that then can get distributed and helping to understand, you know, how much of the pollution emitted inside the Kennecott mine actually gets to us. And what is the contribution from different sources? Figuring out the nuance. There's still basic chemistry that we don't fully understand about how our particulate matter forms in our winter during wintertime inversions, which is actually kind of shocking to me that it's one of the biggest issues here, and yet there's still fundamental science that we don't fully understand about how that process works. And that's getting to some of the nuance of, you know, you don't need to understand everything. You know, ultimately the solution is going to be driving less, you know, fewer precursor emissions, you know, NOx and VOCs. Those are going to be the solutions, but the underlying details of it, there's still a lot that we don't know. How the climate is going to change and how that's going to affect dominant weather patterns. Are we going to get more inversions in the future or fewer? What's our mean temperature? All of those things, there's a lot of science that's left to be done. So that's one of the ways that I'm helping to move the conversation forward. Also participating in panels like this, doing outreach, talking to the local newspapers, doing that sort of outreach is really important. It's a key part of the mission, you know, as a scientist and as a university professor who's working on these issues, there's a mandate to do some of that outreach. And also, for example, participating in the technical advisory group working on the Utah roadmap, providing that insight, saying, you know, here's the data that we have about climate change and air quality impacts in Utah, and in, you know, being part of that discussion so that the decisions moving forward are educated with the best available science. And there was something else, but I forgot, so I'll...
Are you working on a study now that you would release at some point in the near future that will show areas of emissions or NOx and things like that in certain, because we, like you said, we know it's not, you know, areas by the freeway are going to be a little worse because the pollution's concentrated there, then it dissipates across the valley. So is that something you're working on where you'll release a study in the near future?
Yeah, that's something we're definitely working on, those questions. There are many studies that get at that question in different ways, because there are many different questions. The photochemistry of ozone is a little different question of what are the NOx emissions. Our NOx inventories are not very well developed. They're not very well refined. And so we're working on ways to use measurements throughout the valley. One of the projects that I'm working on is we put a suite of instruments on top of a couple of Trax train cars. And as the Trax trains are driving across the city, we see pollution gradients across the city as the trains are moving through the city in different kinds of neighborhoods, different levels of commercialization, industrialization. You know, it goes, the green line goes from West Valley up to the airport, and also a section right along the Jordan River. And there's all sorts of interesting features in that data. What we really need is more people working on it and more funding.
That's a PM 2.5 monitor, or what is it?
We measure PM 2.5, ozone, CO2, and methane. And we also have measured NO2 for about a year. So we're looking at some NOx, some primary emissions, some secondary chemistry, and also trying to relate those to fossil fuel combustion through CO2. Understanding how all of those are related. Sometimes using multiple species together can help us understand emissions sources better. An example of that is that we're using CO2 and the NO2 measurements that we had for for a period of time. And different emission sources will have different signatures of the CO2 to NO2 ratio. And so like diesel versus gas has different ratios of those two species. And so you can use those to figure out which pollution is coming from which sources in different areas of the city. And there's many, many more things that we have yet to discover. So there's many things going on.
And in terms of educating yourself, there's some really fun kind of interactive maps created from the public transit studies showing these like red spikes in pollution going over Bangerter Highway and other parts of Salt Lake. So highly recommend checking it out.
That was Piper Christian, student ambassador for the University of Utah's Sustainability Office. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is Piper Christian, moderator and student ambassador for the University of Utah's Sustainability Office.
Okay, are there other policies being used globally that we should be pushing for here? For example, there have been cities, London and Beijing, that have used a system of monitoring license plates and allowing people to only drive on certain days of the week. Are there other policies we could steal from other cities that you find inspiring?
Well, there's a question of what's possible to do or what other cities have done, and there's a question of what's actually possible to do here because of the culture and the politics. And so you can only push people sort of as fast as they're willing to go. But I think a couple things. The free public transportation that Johnny talked about, there's just a barrier. People don't use public transportation for a couple reasons. One is the first, what we call the first mile, last mile problem, that to get from where they are to where the stop is and where the stop is to where they're going. And so, people hate these scooters, but the scooters are actually one way that you can get that first mile, last mile problem solved. And then, but the more routes we have, the more stops we have, the lower the cost is, the more people are going to use that, and that then leads to the ability to have density. And so one of the things we see when there's a proposal to increase density is there's all sorts of opposition that comes out. We don't want that many people in that area. We don't want smaller houses. We want bigger houses. We want bigger yards. So there's always this opposition to increasing density. And when you have density, more people can use public transportation and more people have shorter distance to go to where they want to go. And so there are very few people when these hearings are held about these developments that come into these hearings and say, we think density is a good thing. We think density is a way that we're going to accommodate this growth that the state is projected to have without necessarily increasing the amount of car trips that have to happen as a result of that. And so it's important that we educate ourselves and then advocate for the solutions rather than just let the people who are resisting these solutions be the dominant voice when they're being discussed in either the municipal or state level.
Yeah, in addition to that scooter, the first last mile thing is there was a study in Portland going on about Lyft and Uber actually helping that as well, where because you can take it to get to the station because we're so spread out. And I've been to London several times, and I think part of that was pollution, but part of that was their traffic issues. That's why that initially came in. And now there's actually a fee to drive into the city because they have so much, not only pollution, but traffic jam problems. And I'm personally would be for that. I'd be for higher taxes on our gasoline. I think the more expensive gasoline gets to put in our tanks, the better, especially if that money is going to mass transit. We have to make it so the subsidies work the other way. Right now we're subsidizing dirty fuel that poisons us all through air pollution, water pollution, and ground pollution. But what we need to subsidize is cleaner energy, cleaner transportation, and there has to be a balance where it's more painful for me to drive up here by myself than it is to take mass transit. Right now, mass transit, it's great, but how they built it, the three lines share one track downtown. So as more people ride it, they're going to have to put in a second line or something because they can't increase the frequency of the train past a certain point. So it's good, but we need to put a lot more money into that system and make it ultimately more painful to drive by yourself than to take some form of mass transit. So, expensive gasoline's never popular, but There you are.
Piper, I'm going to flip the premise of your question on its head.
Go for it.
Because she was asking about, you know, are there policies in other places of the world that could be implemented here? And I think that maybe gets the conversation that we should be having here a little bit backwards, because the reason why is that this next decade, we are already in the middle of a fundamental shift in our energy and economic system that has been based on fossil fuels, and it's going to transition in the next decade to renewable energy through electrification of vehicle fleets and also where we get our power from. That process is being, there's enough innovation that process is in motion, driven by economics. And we're at the point now where there's all these new markets and all this new innovation that's happening across the world. And the places that are putting in policies that encourage that are drawing businesses to those places to find the solutions that are meeting their needs, where they're seeing the future of our energy economy going. And we have, in Utah, that hasn't happened yet. And that's part of why the Utah roadmap is so important. Because if we can provide a direction and say, this is the direction that Utah is going as a conservative state, we could start to draw some of those businesses and those innovators to Utah to find solutions to meet the needs of our new energy economy. So this, to me, I think, and the way you're going to get people on board in Utah is talking about this is what's at stake is the future of Utah's economy. And we can either be a leading role in that, or we can be at the tailing end and not getting any of those benefits. Because there are tons of new economies, and Tesla is going to be building factories like every year for the next foreseeable future, because they are 5 to 10 years ahead of all the other car manufacturers in terms of their technology. And they could build one in Utah and generate a bunch of jobs, or they could build it in Germany, which is what they just announced. And they just built one in China. Mm-hmm. So literally, the question is, are these jobs, and they've already built one in California, that's where it's established. And California has the strictest clean air standards that are driving the electric vehicle transition in the United States. So literally the question is, are those jobs and are those innovations, and is that business gonna be created in China or in Germany or in California or Utah? And when you put it like that, there are a lot of folks in Utah who are really focused on jobs and the future of the economy and interested in how tech can broaden the base of our economic situation in Utah. That gets their attention, and all of a sudden you have an ally instead of an adversary in moving the conversation forward. And that discussion or that topic works for some people who are really focused on jobs, and other people, you really need to talk about taking care of the environment, taking care of clean air. Different messages will work with different audiences, different people, but it's important to recognize and understand the different reasons for taking action so that you can be an effective communicator when you're talking to people. So that would be what I would encourage.
Thank you.
Awesome. One other thing, so we talk about London, Beijing, Portland, other cities, but many of you probably don't know that 23 cities in Utah have committed to 100% renewable energy by the year 2030. That was made possible by a bill that was passed in the legislature last session, House Bill 411, that allows a different rate structure in those cities to be able to bring in renewable energy into those cities. So we pulled, the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. The state is sort of a slower moving ship. But we have 23 cities, and some of them are like Cottonwood Heights, West Valley City, West Jordan, it started with Salt Lake City and Park City, which are sort of the usual suspects, right? But it spread very quickly. They had to get in before the end of December. So we're now a third of the state by 2030 will be living in cities that will be on 100% renewable energy. So there are a lot, we are doing things here that are moving things forward just as much as some of these sort of cities that are held up as models around the world.
And to complete the flipping of the question, we should be asking ourselves, what are the policies we could put in place in Utah that could be exported to the rest of the country and the rest of the world? That's what we should be focused on, I think. And that's a perfect example of that. And there will be a lot of places that are copying Utah's example on HB 411, I guarantee you.
Because if you can do that in a conservative state like Utah, you can do that anywhere.
Yep.
We would like to see the transition move faster than it is. And, we're up against a big behemoth up at the Capitol. I mean, they fought against even having a Tesla dealership here for the longest time. So we really need to push the agenda. That's one reason we're so against the Inland Port, is because that could revive the coal economy. Coal's dying for sure. We are transitioning. There's more people employed by solar than wind than all of oil and gas jobs combined in the United States. But it is not happening easily. I mean, the last administration did a great service to energizing and subsidizing solar, and that is one of the reasons, amongst many, that the price of solar has dropped now, where solar and wind power are actually cheaper to produce than coal and gas and oil. Yet we're still doubling down, the state legislator is still doubling down on this dirty fuel to prop up these faux jobs that are definitely going away either. So we'd be a lot better off retooling, putting education subsidies, retraining workers. And I wanted to ask too, because you were part of the Utah Roadmap, was there any discussion on that? I think the Utah Roadmap is fantastic, and it will be amazing if we can get the elected officials to adopt it. But I was really kind of surprised there was absolutely no mention of the Inland Port in it.
Yeah, I think the Inland Port is a hot topic, and it's fast evolving. And so,
I'm not blaming you. Yeah, I was just curious because that's our biggest issue of the time, in our opinion.
I think that it may. I don't have a specific answer to that.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I just wondered if it was discussed.
But
I found it. I was pretty shocked that it wasn't included in it, because it's legislation that's passed, and so we know it's coming.
Right, but I think that if the Utah Roadmap is adopted or endorsed or whatever the language that the Utah legislature eventually uses, or if they use it, all development would fall under that, and it would be incorporated in that. And so I think it is. It just didn't. You know, there's also big industry, all of the oil and gas industry and all of the, Rocky Mountain Power. And so there's a lot under the purview, and there wasn't very many things that were specifically called out in the report.
Right. I mean, most of those guys were on the technical committee too, right?
Yeah.
Kennecott, Rocky Mountain Power,
yep.
Very
yep.
few,
and in
very
the,
few environmental groups.
Utah Clean Energy was on it, and I think Salt Lake City Sustainability Department was on it.
Yeah, there were several clean energy groups. But one specific example, so the IPP power plant, which is currently coal, it supplies power to the city of Los Angeles, but it's located in south central western in Delta area. They just announced a plan for it to convert to natural gas in the next few years. But then after that, they're not stopping there. They've already announced a plan to then continue the innovation and convert that plant from natural gas over to renewable hydrogen. So producing hydrogen from renewable energy sources. And that would be a demonstration plant of something that could be implemented again around the world. And so that kind of roadmap has already been sketched out for that power plant. And it's, that's an example of where you're starting to change the conversation of where are things going and how can we position ourselves for success? I mean, in my conversations about the future with legislators, I talk about stranded assets. If you build a natural gas power plant today and expect that it's going to be operating in it for 40 years, you're going to be sorely disappointed, and you're going to have to retire it early, most likely, because that's what economics are going to dictate, and it's going to be a waste of money. And so that's the thing that I've been trying to encourage people to think about is, hey, think about where the technology is moving and where their economies are moving, and don't double down on things that's just flushing money down the toilet if you double down on a technology, on a losing technology. And,
That's one of the problems with our coal plants, right? Dominion Energy, they want to, you know more about this than I, Scott, but they want to amortize their costs. They don't want to close those before their life expectancy because they're going to take a huge hit. So somehow we have to help them get to that place.
And the economics are going to dictate it, because solar is already cheaper on a levelized cost basis than coal. And so, and it's going to keep getting cheaper in the next 5-10 years, over the next decade. It's just not going to make any sense. It's not going to make any financial sense to keep those plants operating. And so, Rocky Mountain Power is a regulated utility, and we all like having the lights on. at least I do. And so we need to figure out how to make them successful or figure out an electricity system that is that provides power, reliable, low-cost power, and increasingly in the future, that's going to be fossil fuel-free, clean energy-based, and we need to get from step A to Z, and there's a million things to do to get us there. There's a million jobs, a million problems to figure out, energy storage, long-distance transmission, where's all of the siting, all of the environmental standards, all of those things need to get done. There's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, but I mean, they're regulated because they're a monopoly.
Right.
They're a utility and all those things are true.
Yeah.
But they're not just good players to be good players. I mean, we have to force the issue and accelerate the timeline. We can't, with what's happening in the world and climate change and all those things, we have to take an active approach. I'm not saying you're not saying that, but I want to see all the timelines way accelerated to what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, well, thank you for your comments. I've learned so much about Utah energy and what's currently going on from these discussions. But we would like to open it up briefly for audience Q&A. So if you would like to ask a question, please raise your hand and we will bring you the microphone to ensure high quality. And to ensure high quality recording and productive discussion, we request that you do not ask your question without the microphone. And we will be taking student questions first. And before we transition to that, because we mentioned opportunities for students to get engaged in environmental projects on campus, I'm the co-president of Utah Climate Advocates, and we are hosting a environmental lobby training tomorrow at 6 p.m. in this building, Gardner Commons, room 2760. We've been really engaged in both on-campus and legislative sustainability. We hosted the Inland Port panel that Johnny recently attended and spoke at. So if you're interested, please come speak to me after. I'd love to share more.
In case you don't know, Piper is like the rock star of student environmental advocacy. So,
thank you. All right. So, yeah, students or audience Q&A.
So, for the past 15 years of living in Utah, clean air has been framed in terms of health, which makes a lot of sense. Obviously, the inversion is its own unique phenomena. But do you think that there is something to be gained by tying up this conversation in the larger one being had about climate change, in specifically the future of fuel sources and what we're going to have to transition to in the next decade?
That actually is being done. And so one of the ways for the climate change skeptics in the legislature, one of the ways to sort of get around that is to talk to them about air quality, because they're hearing that from the PTA, they're hearing that from the people at their church, they're hearing that from people who come here to look at locating business on an inversion day and say, we don't want to come here because we don't want this. So we're sort of using air quality as a foil in many ways to talk about climate change, because a lot of the solutions are overlapping.
And just to emphasize that point, the solutions are overlapping, the problems are overlapping. Everything that, every fossil fuel combustion that contributes to climate change also contributes to poor air quality. So different messages will work with different audiences. Some people care a lot about climate change and about the climate impacts in Utah, whether it's the snowpack, water availability, temperatures, the health impacts, the mosquitoes, vector-borne diseases, et cetera. Some people really care. Some people don't care about that and only want to talk about air quality. So you meet people where they are and what they care about, find common ground, and build consensus. And I think that's how we make progress in the state of Utah. And the Utah roadmap specifically talks about both climate change and air quality to further educate people about how those two subjects are interrelated and how the solutions are closely related as well.
Yeah. UPHE believes the climate's changing, and we believe it's human-induced behavior. My brother doesn't believe that, and so I'm pretty sure he's adopted. I'm not sure how he could come to that conclusion. But it's, I think that's a great question, and like these guys are talking about, knowing the audience, because we all want to breathe clean air. That shouldn't be, I was shocked to learn that's a partisan issue. You know, so if you don't believe in climate change, you don't believe it's human-induced, then okay, well, you don't want to breathe air that's going to kill you or premature, you know, lead to premature death. So depends on the audience, I reckon. But I think all of us up here, you know, talk about climate change as often as we can.
I know that last year Colorado passed a number of like pretty progressive emissions and energy generation laws, and I know that the politics are really different between the two states, but I was wondering if you noticed at the state level or in certain discussions any sort of response on the Utah side for that, or if you see in the near future any, like, if you're optimistic for sort of like feedback between, you know, if like momentum between the two states could sort of feed off of each other, if the landscapes are just too different sort of politically for that.
I think the landscapes are too different. I mean, California, as Logan was saying, has done some really good work in regulating air quality. We can't even say the word California at the legislature. If we say this is a California standard, that's the end of the discussion up there. Colorado isn't quite in that league, but close in terms of the way that Utah legislators, we have this thing in Utah where we think all of the best solutions are invented here. And you just have to go with that, because if you try to sort of push and fight against it, you get dismissed and you don't get listened to. I mean, there is a role for pushing, and that needs to be done as part of it. But when finally the solution gets crafted, you're in the room trying to figure out what we're actually going to do here. There's a few legislators. Patrice Arendt, who is retiring this year, who's been an air quality champion, often will look to what other states are doing to decide what bills she thinks she can run here. But then she never references those as having been done somewhere else. She usually just sort of puts a Utah stamp on it. And as a Democrat, been very, very successful in getting bills passed.
I mean, the Region 8 for the Environmental Protection Agency is based in Denver, and we were just in a conversation with the new administrator that came to Utah. But they have non-attainment issues. They have terrible air quality in Denver, and so they can't even solve it in their own backyard. So it's a real challenge for sure.
All right, we have time for one more question.
Do you see any possibility of the legislature redirecting some of the development money for development for other areas other than Salt Lake City as a way of lessening the impact of growth on Salt Lake City?
No.
Well, there's the rural legislative caucus or has quite a bit of power at the Utah legislature. I think actually often it's the other way around, that what could get done in Salt Lake City gets stopped because rural legislators have enough of a power base up there. I mean, Salt Lake City had an anti-idling ordinance, and the legislature took that authority away. Now, Patrice was able to get it back, but anytime Salt Lake City tries to do something that pushes the limits a little bit, the legislature usually says, we're not gonna let municipalities do that. So I actually think there is more focus on rural Utah, but I don't think the legislature can solve the economic problems of rural Utah without what Logan was saying, changing the sort of idea of what innovation can look like here, and then figuring out how to allow that to happen in nodes around the state.
I mean, we got to get to a place where it's not, the economy includes other things besides growth, right? There's a Chilean economist who talks about barefoot economics, and we need to include everything in economy and the cost of growth, our personal health, and our surrounding area, our quality of life. So we need stricter certifications on building standards. We need to make sure they're as green as they can possibly be. We need to consider, is there water available before we give tax breaks and our tax dollars away to unfettered development just for the sake of jobs and the economy? It's especially when we're doing so well as a state. So I doubt if it'll ever happen, but I'm trying to fight the good fight to make sure it does. But we need voices everyone can contribute. You know, it's a personal choice of how we spend our dollar, but don't give your dollar to companies that are bad players. You know what I mean? If you want to lower your impact, try to buy locally, try to buy from small business, not huge corporations. Adopt a plant-based diet if you really care about climate change. There's lots of things we can do, as well as pushing our elected officials. I mean, vote for people that have our best interests at stake, not for people that are giving our tax dollars away for the sake of growth.
Okay, Well, please join me in thanking our guests for an interesting and informative forum. Thank you.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.